interference was being held down on the coordinate frequency. Knowing what he did now about teleportation, he realized that motors could not run during a firing. It was an important point. Teleportation motors interfered with the teleportation and transshipment. That was why the cyclos didn't locally teleport ore on the planet from one point to another, but used freighters. A small motor was one thing, but teleportation of ore was reserved for transport between planets and universes. Apparently, if any motor were running around the transshipment area while those wires were humming and building up, it would mess up the firing due to overly disturbed local space. Johnny knew he was now watching a holding between the space of Cyclo and the space of this planet. A secondary holding was just keeping coordinates punched in, and he could visualize the operators in that control tower punching consoles with staccato pause to keep this planet and Cyclo lined up for the second firing. It was the second one Johnny was interested in. It apparently would not take place for a while. He turned off his picto-recorder remote. After a wait, he timed it and found it was 1 hour and 13 minutes. The white light on the dome began a very rapid flashing. The bullhorn bawled, "Stand by for return firing to Cyclo." A semi-annual seemed to use up far more electricity. Technicians had auxiliary bus bars closed on the high poles. There was still a faint hum in the air. Sweepers rolled and whirred over the firing platform, cleaning it, getting rid of scraps the new personnel may have dropped. Johnny noticed that the conveyor belt detectors were not manned, and all the ore apparatus was standing still, neglected. He had hoped to pass by the ore duster with the sample from the load in his pocket and see whether the ore duster registered any uranium mixed in with the gold. But he couldn't. The thing wasn't running. Turl came rumbling down toward the morgue. Johnny turned on his picto recorder. Cyclos were getting busy again around the firing platform. The bullhorn bawled, "Coordinates holding and linked in second stage." They were still lined up with Cyclo. Johnny envisioned that far-off planet, universes away, purple and heavy, like a huge discolored boil, infecting and painting the universes. He knew there were scraps of its space right in front of him, linked to the space of Earth. Cyclo, a parasite larger than the host, voracious, pitiless, without even a word for cruelty. Turl was now opening up the morgue. Small lift trucks dashed by him and into it. Turl stood there watching, a list in his hand. The first lift truck came out. Turl looked at the closed coffin number and checked his list. The truck with the huge coffin borne in its claws sped to the firing platform and dumped its burden with a thud. The coffin teetered and then fell flat. A second truck came out of the morgue with another coffin. Turl read the number and checked it off, and that coffin was carried up and dumped on the firing platform. Then, rapidly, a third and a fourth truck repeated the action. The first truck was bringing another coffin out. Johnny watched while 16 coffins were piled this way and that, carelessly, on the platform. A line of returning personnel were dropped off a flatbed ground truck with their baggage near Turl at the morgue. He went through their clothing and glanced into their effects. There were 12 of them. As they finished, the lift trucks moved them and their baggage to the firing platform. The white light went steady. "Coordinates on first stage," bawled the bullhorn. "Motors off." The 12 departing cyclos stood there or sat on their mounds of baggage. The 16 coffins were mixed up with the baggage. It suddenly struck Johnny that nobody waved or said goodbye. It meant nothing to anyone here that these creatures were going home. Or maybe it did, he thought, looking more closely. The machine operators around seemed to be moving with more savage jerks. One couldn't see well into their helmets, or at this distance, but Johnny felt they resented the homegoers. A red light over the operations area began to flash. A horn wailed. The bullhorn bawled, "Stand clear." The wires began to hum. Johnny glanced at his watch. The tree leaves quivered. The ground vibrated. The hum of the wires gradually and slowly built to a roar. 2 minutes went by. On went the purple light. A wavering haze appeared over the platform. The personnel and coffins were gone. Then Johnny noticed an undulating wave of sound and a quiver in the wires. It was almost like a recoil. A different horn went off. A white light flashed. The bullhorn bawled, "Firing completed. Start motors and resume normal actions." Turl was locking the morgue. He came rumbling up the slope. Johnny turned off his picto recorder remote and started to move off. Turl seemed to be very distracted, but the movement caught his eye.
"Don't hang around here," snapped Turl.
Johnny guided his horse toward him. In a low guttural, Turl said,
"You must not be seen around here anymore. Now clear out."
"What about the girls?"
"I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it."
"I wanted to give you the report."
"Shut up."
Turl looked around. Was he frightened? He drew close to the horse's shoulder, bringing his eyes to the level of Johnny's head.
"I'll come over and see you tomorrow. Hereafter, don't come near this place."
"I..."
"Go over to your car and get to your base, right now."
And Turl made sure that he did. It took a very dicey scout that night to recover the picto recorder from the tree. But with a heat shield to prevent detection, Johnny did it. What was up with Turl? Chapter 8 1 "It looks like it will be almost impossible to get out," said Johnny, "and it's going to take an awful lot of advice and skill." He was uneasy about the state Turl was in. Their conference was already 2 days late. They were meeting in an abandoned mine drift, a workings 50 feet underground and a mile south of the defense base. It was dusty. The timbers sagged. It was a dangerous place to be due to the possibility of cave-in. Turl had come silently to the base, having parked his ground car some distance away under brush in a ravine, and walked the rest of the distance in the night, a mining heat shield over his head. Silently, with gestures, he had made the night sentry, who almost shot him, so mysteriously did he materialize in the dark, get Johnny. He had then led Johnny to this abandoned drift and checked around them with a probe. But the monster did not seem to be attending to what was going on. Johnny had shown him the pictures of the load on a portable viewer he had brought, and explained about the overheating motor, about the wind. Turl had emitted a few mutters, but little else. For Turl was a very worried cyclo. When the crowd had arrived at the semi-annual, Turl had been efficiently going down the line checking them out. He was almost two-thirds finished when he found himself face to face with him. The newcomer had his head down, and the dome firing helmet was not too clean to see through, but there was no mistaking. It was Jayed. Turl had seen him once while a student at the school. There had been a crime nobody ever learned about, and Jayed had been the agent who appeared to handle it. He was not a company agent. He was a member of the dreaded Imperial Bureau of Investigation, the IBI itself. There was no mistaking him. Round, jowled face, left front fang splintered, discolored mouth and eye bones, mange eroding his paws. It was Jayed, all right. It was such a shock that Turl had not been quick-witted enough to go on with his inspection. He had simply passed on the rest of the line. Jayed didn't seem to notice, but the great IBI never missed anything. What was he there for? Why had he come to this planet? On the incoming receipt forms, he was listed as SNIT and designated as General Labor. This meant to Turl that Jayed must be undercover. But why? Was it Numphs messing with payrolls? Or, and Turl shuddered, was it the animals and the gold? His first impulse was to load up blast rifles and rush over and wipe out the animals, return the vehicles, and claim it was all Numph's idea, and that he had had to step in and handle it. For 2 days, however, Turl waited around to see whether Jayed would sidle up to him and confide. He gave the fellow every chance, but Jayed simply went into the general labor force at the local mine. Turl didn't dare put a button camera near him. Jayed would detect that. He didn't dare interrogate the workers around Jayed to see what questions the agent was asking. Jayed would hear it right back. No button cameras appeared in Turl's area. Probes detected no remote devices beaming in on him. A very tense Turl had then decided to be very wary and wait for the first outgoing dispatch box, for Jayed might possibly put a report into it. Sitting there, looking at the load on the screen, Turl gradually forced himself to focus his eyes. Yes, it did appear difficult. He knew it would be.
"You say wind?" said Turl.
"Overheats the motors. A flying drill platform would not be able to hold itself in place long enough to do any effective work." The miner in Turl stirred.
"Long spike rods driven into the cliffside. One could build a platform on that. It's precarious, but the rods sometimes hold."
"One would have to have a place to land on top."
"Blast a flat place out."
Johnny flipped a slide and showed him the crack, the possibility of the whole load shearing off and plummeting to the bottom of the gorge. "Can't blast."
"Drills," said Turl. "Possibly flatten a place with just drills. Tedious, but it could be done. Fly back of the cliff edge and drill toward the chasm."
But he was drifting off, abstracted. Johnny realized that Turl was scared of something, and he realized something else. If this project were abandoned, Turl's first action would be to kill all of them, either to cover evidence or just out of plain sadism. Johnny decided it was up to him to keep Turl interested.
"That might work," said Johnny.
"What?"
said Turl. "Drilling from back of the chasm toward it, keeping a ship out of the wind while it hovers."
"Oh, that, yes."
Johnny knew he was losing him. To Turl, it wasn't a screen in front of him. It was the face of Jayed.
"I haven't shown you the core," said Johnny.
He tilted the portable lamp and brought the core out of his pocket. It was an inch in diameter and about 6 inches long, pure white quartz and gleaming gold. Johnny tipped it about so it sparkled. Turl came out of his abstraction.
"What a beautiful specimen."
He took hold of it. With one talon, he delicately dented the gold.
"Pure gold."
He fondled it. Suddenly, he saw himself on Cyclo, powerful and rich, living in a mansion, doors open to him everywhere. Talons pointing on the street with whispers,
"That's Turl." "Beautiful," said Turl. "Beautiful."
After a long time, Johnny said,
"We'll try to get it out."
Turl stood up in the narrow drift, and dust eddied in the lamp. He still fondly gripped the core.
"You keep it," said Johnny.
Suddenly, it was as though the core were hot.
"No, no, no," said Turl. "You must hide it. Bury it in a hole."
"All right, and we'll try to mine the load."
"Yes," said Turl.
Johnny breathed a pent-up sigh of relief. But at the drift entrance, before they parted, Turl said,
"No radio contacts, none. Do not overfly the compound. Skim the mountains on the east. Fly low, leaving and arriving at this base. Make a temporary second base in the hills, and do your shifts from that. And stay away from the compound. I'll see the females are fed."
"I should go over and tell them they won't be seeing me."
"Why?"
"They worry."
Johnny saw that Turl couldn't comprehend that and amended it quickly.
"They might make a fuss, create a disturbance."
"Right. You can go once more, in the dark. Here, here's a heat shield. You know where my quarters are. Flash a dim light 3 times.
"You could just let me take the girls over to the base."
Oh no you don't.
Turl patted his remote control.
You're still under my orders.
Johnny watched as he rumbled off and vanished in the night. Fear was preying on Turl, and in that state, Turl would vacillate and change his mind. It was a troubled Johnny who went back to the base. 2. They were overflying the load area, Johnny, Robert the Fox, the three near duplicates, and the shift leaders. They were high up. The air was crystal and the mountains spread grandly about them. They were looking for a possible landing site back from the chasm.
Aye, 'tis the devil's own problem, said Robert the Fox.
Impossible terrain, said Johnny.
No, I don't mean that, said Robert the Fox. It's this Turl demon. On the one hand, we have to keep this mining going and fruitful, and on the other, the last thing we want is for him to succeed. I knew very well he'd kill us all if he lost hope, but I'd rather be dead than see him win.
Time is on our side, said Johnny, turning the plane for another pass over the edge.
Aye, time, said Robert the Fox. Time has a nasty habit of disappearing like the wind from a bagpipe. If we haven't made it by day 91, we're finished.
McTyler, called Dunaldine from the back. Put your eyes on that space about 200 feet back from the edge. A bit west. That looks flatter.
There was a bark of laughter from the others. Nothing was flat down there. From the edge and back, the terrain was tumbled like a miniature Alps, all stone outcrops and sharp-toothed boulders. No place was flat enough even to set this plane down.
Take over, Dunaldine, said Johnny. He slid sideways and let the Scott into the pilot's seat. Johnny made sure he had control and then went into the back. He picked up a coil of explosive cord and began to put himself into harness. The others helped him.
I want you to hold about 10 feet above that spot. I'll go down and have a try at blasting it flat.
No, said Robert the Fox.
He gestured at David McKean, a shift leader.
Take that away from him, Davy. You're not to be so bold yourself, McTyler.
Sorry, said Johnny. I know these mountains. It was so illogical that it stopped Robert the Fox. He laughed.
You're a bonny lad, McTyler, but a bit wild.
Dunaldine had them hovering over the spot, and Johnny wrestled with the door to get it open.
Proves I'm a Scot, he said.
The others didn't laugh. They were too tense with concern. The plane was making small jumps and jerks, and the sharp ground bobbed up and down below. Even here, 200 feet from the edge, there was wind. Johnny was lowered to the ground and let the pickup rope go slack. Not too much blast or that cliff would shear off again. It might even break off downward. Johnny examined the ground and chose a sharp tooth. He girdled it with explosive cord, getting it as low and level as possible. He set the fuse. At a wave of his hand, the pickup rope tightened and yanked him into the air. He hung there, spinning in the wind. The explosive cord flashed and the roar racketed around the mountains, echoing. They lowered him again into the wind-whipped dust, and with a spike gun he drove a spike into the rock he had blasted loose. A line came down to him, and he put it through the eye of the spike. If he had judged correctly, the tooth should shear away. He was hauled up higher. The plane's motors screamed. The rock came away. They lowered the pickup line and he cut the haul cord with a clipper. The huge rock bounded into a hollow, leaving a flat place where it had stood. For an hour, grounded and hauled away alternately, Johnny worked. Some of the blasted rock fell into nearby hollows. Gradually, a flattish platform 50 feet in diameter materialized 200 feet back from the cliff edge. The plane landed. David, the shift leader, crept over the broken ground to the crack 30 feet in from the edge. The wind buffeted his bonnet. He put a measuring instrument down into the crack that would tell them if it widened in the future. Johnny went over to the edge of the cliff and, with Thor holding his ankles, tried to look under it and see the load. He couldn't.
The cliff face was not vertical. The others clambered around, seeing what they could. Johnny came back to the plane. His hands were scraped. This place had to be worked with mittens. He'd ask the old women to make some.
Well, said Robert the Fox, we got Dune.
The daily recon drone rumbled in the distance. They had their orders. The three near duplicates of Johnny dove for the plane and out of sight. Johnny stood out in the open. There was plenty of time. The sharp crack of the sonic boom hit them like a club as the recon drone went overhead. The plane and ground shook. The drone dwindled in the distance.
I hope the vibrations of that thing, said Dunaldine, emerging, don't split the cliff.
Johnny gathered the others around him. We have a supply point now. First thing to do is pound in a security fence so nothing can slide off and construct a shift shelter, right? They nodded. Tomorrow, said Johnny, we'll bring two planes, one loaded with equipment and the other equipped to drive rods. We'll try to construct a working platform to mine the load, balanced on rods driven into the cliff just below the vein. Survey up here right now on what equipment we need for safety reels, ore buckets, and so on. They got to work to mine the gold they didn't want but had to have. Gold was the bait in the trap. 3. Johnny lay in the dead grass on a knoll and studied the far-off compound through a pair of cyclo-infrared night glasses. He was worried about Chrissy. 2 months had gone by, and he felt their chances were worsening. The only blessing was that the winter snows were late, but not the winter cold, and the wind sighing through the night was bitter. The huge night glasses were icy to the touch. The binocular character of them made them hard to use. The two eyepieces being cyclo were so far apart he could only use one at a time. The faint light of the dying moon reflected from the snow-capped peak behind him and gave a faint luminescence to the plain. He was trying to see her fire. From this vantage point, he knew by experience that he should be able to. So far, he could not find even the tiniest pinpoint of it. The last time he had seen her, 2 months ago, he had piled the cage with wood, given her some wheat to boil, and even a few late radishes and lettuces, all from the old women's garden. She had a fair supply of smoked meat, but it would not last forever. He had tried rather unsuccessfully to cheer her up and give her confidence he himself was not feeling. He had also given her one of the stainless steel knives the scout had found, and she had pretended to be amazed and delighted with it, and the way it could scrape a hide and cut thin strips of meat. In all these 2 months, he had not heard from Turl. Forbidden to go to the compound, having no radio contact, he had waited in vain for Turl to come to the base. Perhaps Turl thought they had moved. True, they had put an emergency camp near the mine site down in a hidden valley. They had moved extra machines, supplies, and the three shifts for the load, and one of the old women to cook and wash for them. There was an abandoned mining village there, and it was a short flight to the load. The efforts to mine the vein were not going well. They had driven the steel bars into the cliff and tried to build a platform, but the wind, meeting resistance, kept flexing the rods at the point of contact with the cliff, and the section there would become red hot. It was daredevil work. 2 rods had already broken, and only safety lines had saved Scots from plummeting 1,000 feet to their deaths. 2 months' work in bitter and ferocious winds. And they had only a few pounds of wire gold to show for it. Gold grabbed, as it were, on the fly. This was the 5th night he had lain here and looked in vain for the fire that should be there. 5 nights before, not seeing the fire, they had sent a scout. There had been a row with the council and the others when they found he was determined to slip down there himself. They had literally barred the door on him. Robert the Fox had become cross with him and shouted into his ears that chiefs didn't scout. They might raid, but never scout. It was too dangerous for him. He was not expendable. He had argued and found the rest of the council taking Robert's side. And when other Scots heard the raised voices, they came and stood around the council, as they had a right to do, they said, and added their arguments against his taking senseless risks with his person. It had been quite a row, and they were right. They had sent, as a compromise, young Fergus. He went off like a shadow through the cold moonlight, and they waited out the hours. Somehow young Fergus got home. He was badly wounded. The flesh of his shoulder was seared like beef. He had gotten almost to the small plateau in front of the cage. The moon had set by then. There was no fire in the cage. But there was something new at the compound. Sentries. The area was patrolled by one armed cyclo near the cages, and one or more guards walking the perimeter of the compound. The guard at the cage had fired at a shadow. Fergus had gotten away only by howling like a wolf in pain, for the sentry supposed he had shot a wolf, common enough on the plains. Fergus was in the makeshift hospital now, shoulder packed in bear grease and herbs. He would get well, clucked over by one of the old women. He was triumphant rather than cowed, for he had proven the majority opinion right. The other Scots, singly and in groups, informed MacTyler that the point was proven beyond any doubt. A chief must not go on scout. Raid yes, scout no. The parson had consoled Johnny. In Johnny's quarters, when they were alone, the parson had patiently explained,
"It isn't that they feel you can't do it, nor even actually that maybe they themselves couldn't go on if something happened to you. It's just that they're fond of you, laddie. It's you who gave us the hope."
Lying in the tall grass, using binoculars built for an alien face, Johnny did not feel much hope. Here they were, a tiny group of a vanishing race, on a planet itself small and out of the way, confronting the most powerful and advanced beings in the universes. From galaxy to galaxy, system to system, world to world, the Cyclos were supreme. They had smashed every sentient race that had ever sought to oppose them, and even those that had tried to cooperate. With advanced technology and a pitiless temperament, the Cyclos had never been successfully opposed in all the rapacious eons of their existence. Johnny thought of the trench, of the 67 cadets with pathetically inadequate weapons trying to stop a Cyclo tank and dying for it, taking with them the last hope of the human race. No, not the last hope, thought Johnny. 1,000 or more years later, here were the Scots and himself. But what a forlorn hope. One casual sortie from that compound with one old Cyclo ground tank, and the hope would be ended. Yes, Johnny and the Scots could probably attack that compound. They could probably wipe out several mine sites and even end this present operation. But the Cyclo Company would sweep in and extort a revenge that would end it all forever. Yes, he had a potential weapon, but not only did he have no uranium, he didn't even have a detector. He had nothing at all to tell him where to look, or even whether something was uranium. He and the Scots had a very forlorn hope indeed. He put the binoculars on maximum magnification. One last sweep on that sleeping compound way over there. Nightlights, green pinpoints under the domes, but no yellow-orange fire. He was about to give it up for the night when his sweeping glasses picked up the fuel dump. There were piled the cartridges that powered the machines. A bit distant, safely away in case of a blow-up, was the explosives magazine. Plenty of explosives for mining, but even blowing the whole thing up would not really jar the compound. And there were the battle planes, 20 of them lined up on a ready line. Across the transshipment area from the battle planes, and distant from all the rest, but closer to the cage area, was the breathe gas dump. The company didn't care how much breathe gas it stockpiled. In huge drums and small mask bottles, there must be enough breathe gas there to last the mining operation 50 years. It was piled higgledy-piggledy. It was never checked out. Machine operators simply picked up canisters for their canopies and masks. There was too much of it to require conservation. The glasses swept on. Johnny was looking for sentries now. He found one of them. The cyclo was waddling lazily through the dark between the breathe gas dump and the transshipment platform. Yes, there was another one, up on the plateau near the cage. Suddenly, Johnny swept the glasses back to the breathe gas dump. Aside from a half-dozen trodden paths, the place was surrounded by tall weeds and grass, and the undergrowth and ground cover stretched out to the horizon. He brought the glasses back to the breathe gas dump. Suddenly, with a surge of hope, he knew he had his uranium detector. Breathe gas. A small bottle of it would let out, through its regulator, the minute quantities required for masks. If one let a little breathe gas escape in the vicinity of radiation, it would make a small explosion. A Geiger counter reacted when the radiation activated gas in a tube, or so the old books told him. Well, breathe gas didn't just react, it exploded violently. Dangerous sort of instrument, perhaps, but with care it just might work. Johnny snaked back off the knoll. 20 minutes later, at the base, he was saying to the council, "A chief mustn't go on a scout, right?" "Aye," they all agreed, glad he had gotten the point at last. "But he can go on a raid," said Johnny. They became stiffly alert. "I may have solved the uranium detector problem," said Johnny. "Tomorrow night, we are going on a raid." 4. Johnny crept toward the plateau near the cage. The moon had set. The night was dark. The sounds of distant wolves mingled with the moan of the icy wind. He heard above it the click of equipment as the sentry moved. Things had definitely not gone well tonight. The first plan had been aborted, making for last-minute changes. All afternoon, a mixed herd of buffalo and wild cattle had been ideally located on the plain. It was said that when a winter was going to be a very bad one, buffalo drifted down from the vastnesses of the north. Or perhaps it was a sort of migration to the south that would happen anyway. The wolves, long and gray, a different kind of wolf, came with them. The wolves were still out there, but the buffalo and cattle were not. The plan had been to stampede the mixed herd across the compound and create a diversion. It happened now and then and would not be suspicious. But just as the raid was about to be launched, the herd had taken it into their heads to trot eastward and were now too far away to be of any use. It was a bad omen. It meant hastily changed plans and a raid with no diversion. Dangerous. 20 Scots were scattered out there on the plain, among them Dunaldine. They were caped and hooded, as was Johnny, with the heat-deflecting fabric used in drilling. A mixture of powdered grass and glue made from hoofs had been painted over the costume. With this, infrared would read them like part of the surrounding grass. Even visually, they could be mistaken for the general terrain. The Scots were under specific orders to converge upon the breathe gas dump, separately pick up cases of small pressure cylinders, and get back to the base. The trick was to raid an enemy who would never know he had been raided. They must not suspect at the compound that the animals were hostile. It was a raid that must look like no raid. The Scots must not take any weapons, must not collide with any sentries, must not leave any traces. There was some protest that Johnny was going to go to the cage. He explained, not really believing it, that this way he would be behind any sentries who might converge upon the dump if a disturbance was noted. Johnny gripped a kill club and stole forward toward the plateau. And his next ill chance was awaiting him. The horses were not there. Perhaps nervous because of the wolves or seeking better grazing, they had wandered off. Through the glasses, Johnny had seen two of them last night. He had planned to creep up the last distance by guiding a horse alongside of him. All his horses were trained to strike with their front hoofs on command, and if the sentry were alerted and had to be hit, it would look like the cyclo had simply tangled with a horse. No horses. Wait. A dim increase in blackness in the black at the bottom of the cliff ahead of him. Johnny sighed with relief as the crunch of dry grass being munched came to him. But when he arrived, it was only Blodgett, the horse with the crippled shoulder, probably not given to much wandering due to the lameness. Oh well, better Blodgett than none at all. The horse nuzzled him in greeting, but obeyed the order to be silent. With a hand on Blodgett's jaw, causing the horse to stop a bit every few feet, walking back of the horse's shoulder and protected from any detector the sentry might be carrying, Johnny quietly approached the cage. If he could get within striking distance of the sentry, and if Blodgett remembered the training, and if the lame shoulder permitted, Johnny intended to take out the sentry. The cyclo was looming up under the reflected glow of a dim green light burning somewhere in the dome. There was no fire in the cage. 20 feet, 15 feet, 10 feet. Suddenly, the sentry turned, alert. 10 feet, way out of striking distance. But just as Johnny was about to launch the kill club, he saw that the sentry was listening back of himself. There was a tiny whisper of crackling sound. Johnny knew what it was, a radio intercom plugged into the sentry's ear. Some other sentry had spoken to him over it. The cyclo hefted the 6 cumbersome feet of his blast rifle. He muttered something inside his own helmet dome, answering. The other sentry must be down by the dump. Had a Scott been seen? Was the operation blown? The cage sentry went lumbering off to the other side of the compound in the direction of the dump. Whatever was going on down there, Johnny had his own mission. He moved quickly up to the wooden barrier. Chrissy, he whispered as loudly as he dared into the darkness of the cage. Silence. Chrissy, he hissed more urgently.
Johnny,
a whisper came back, but it was Patty's voice. Yes, where is Chrissy?
She's here, Johnny.
There were tears in back of Patty's whisper.
Johnny, we don't have any water. The pipes froze.
She sounded very weak herself, possibly ill. There was an odor in the air, and in the green dimness, Johnny spotted a pile of dead rats outside the door. Dead rats that had not been taken in and were rotting. Do you have any food?
Very little, and we have had no firewood for a week.
Johnny felt a fury rising in himself. But he must be fast. They had no time. And Chrissy?
Her head is hot. She just lies here. She doesn't answer me. Johnny, please help us.
Hold on, said Johnny hoarsely. In a day or two, you'll get help, I promise. Tell Chrissy. Make her understand. He could do little right now. Is there ice in the pool?
A little. Very dirty.
Use the heat of your body to melt it. Patty, you must hold on for a day or two.
I'll try.
Tell Chrissy I was here. Tell her... What did girls want to hear? What could he say? Tell her that I love her. It was true enough. There was a sharp sound down by the dump. Johnny knew he couldn't stay. Something, somebody was in trouble down there. Gripping Blodgett's mane to drag the horse along, Johnny ran silently to the other side of the compound. He started down the hill toward the dump. He knew exactly where it was, but there were no lights. Yes, there was a light. A sentry flashlight flicked across the dump. 2 sentries were down there. The silhouettes against the dump showed they were 100 feet this side of it. Johnny covered himself with the horse and went down the hill. A light flicked at him, dazzling. It passed on. Just one of those damned horses, said a voice ahead of him. I tell you, there's something to the right of that dump. Turn on your scanner. A thudding sound came from the dump like a box being overturned. There is something over there, said the sentry. They started to advance, flashlight playing before them. It silhouetted them to Johnny. He crept the horse forward. Johnny saw what had happened. A messily stacked tier of boxes had overturned when someone touched one. With better night sight than the light-blinded sentries, he saw a Scot move and then begin to run away. No, a sentry saw it. The sentry was raising the blast rifle to fire. What a bad night. The cyclos would know the animals were raiding them. A wounded or dead Scot in a heat camouflage cape would give it all away. The cyclos would retaliate. They'd wipe out the base. 20 feet away, the sentry was shoving off the safety catch, aiming. The kill club struck him like a lightning bolt in the center of his back. Johnny was racing forward, unarmed now. The other sentry turned. The light hit Johnny. The cyclo raised his blast rifle to fire. Johnny was past him, grasping the muzzle of the huge gun. He spun it out of his paws. Johnny reversed the weapon to use the butt. There must be no shots to wake the compound. The cyclo turned and tried to grab him. The rifle butt crunched into the sentry's stomach and he folded. Johnny thought he was home free, but he wasn't. The ground shook. A third sentry came running up. The light from the fallen flashlight shone on the huge rushing legs. The third sentry had a belt gun drawn. He was 5 feet away, raising his weapon to fire. Holding the blast rifle by its muzzle, Johnny hurled the butt into the third one's helmet. There was a crack of splitting helmet glass, then a hoarse intake of hostile air. The cyclo went down. The first one was trying to get up and bring a weapon to bear. Johnny crashed the butt of the rifle down on his chest, and his helmet came loose. He choked a strangled gasp as the air hit him. "My God," Johnny agonized. 3 sentries to explain. Unless he acted, they were for it and washed up the whole way. He forced the rages of combat back to calmness. He heard Blodgett running off. Somewhere up in the compound, a door slammed. This place would be swarming. He stamped out the flashlight. Raking through his pockets, he searched for a thong. He found one, found 2. He pieced them together. He reached down and got hold of the first sentry's blast rifle. He tied the extended thong to the trigger. Then, with all his might, he plunged the muzzle of the blast rifle into the ground, choking its bore with dirt and leaving it erect. He hunched down behind the protection of the first sentry's body. There were running feet coming down from the compound. Doors were slamming. They would be here any instant. He made sure he was protected from sight of the compound and from the blast, and pulled the thong. The choked blast rifle exploded like a bomb. The corpse before him jolted. Geysered dirt and rocks began to fall back. But Johnny was gone. 2 hours later, with his side aching from running, Johnny came back to the base. Robert the Fox had seen that no unusual lights were on and had the place organized in case of pursuit. As the raiders came in one by one, he had their boxes of breathe gas carefully hidden in a basement and collected them in a silent group in the faintly lit auditorium. He had 15 Scots standing by with submachine guns and passenger ships lined up in case they had to evacuate. The camouflaged capes had been removed and hidden. No evidence left in sight. No precaution untaken. Withdrawal, if called for, already organized. Robert the Fox was an efficient veteran of many a raid in his own homeland.
"Did we leave anyone?" panted Johnny.
19 came back," said Robert the Fox. "Dunnell Dean is still out there."
Johnny didn't like it. He looked around at the 19 raiders in the hall. They were concentrating on getting themselves back to normal, straightening their bonnets, picking grass off themselves, winding down. A runner from the lookout with night glasses posted on top of a building came in with the message,
"No pursuit visible. New planes have taken off."
"That was one devil of an explosion," said Robert the Fox.
"It was a blast rifle that blew up," said Johnny. "When the barrel is clogged, they blow back and explode their whole magazine of 500 rounds.
"Sure made the echoes ring," said Robert the Fox. "We heard it over here. Miles away."
"They are loud," said Johnny. He sat panting on a bench. "I've got to figure out how to get a message to Turl. Chrissy is ill, and they're without water. No firewood."
The Scots tensed. One of them spat the word, "Cyclos."
"I'll figure a way to get a message," said Johnny. "Any sign of Dunnell Dean?" he called to a messenger at the door. The messenger went off to the lookout. The group waited. Minutes ticked on. Half an hour went by. They were strained. Finally, Robert the Fox stood up and said,
"Well, bad as it is, we better..."
There was the thud of running feet. Dunnell Dean came racing through the door and sank down, panting. He was not just panting, he was also laughing.
"No sign of pursuit," the messenger shouted in.
The tension vanished. Dunnell Dean delivered a box of breathe gas vials, and the parson rushed off to hide it in case of search.
"No planes have taken off," the messenger yelled into the room.
"Well, for now, laddies," said Robert the Fox. "Unless the devils are waiting for daylight."
"They won't come," said Dunnell
Dean. Others were drifting into the room. Submachine guns were being uncocked. Pilots came in from the passenger standby planes. Even the old women were peering in the door. Nobody knew yet what had gone wrong out there. Dunnell Dean had his breath, and the parson was moving around serving out small shots of whiskey.
"I stayed behind to see what they would do," said the cheerful Dunnell Dean. "Ooh, and you should have seen our Johnny."
He gave a highly colored account. He had been one of the last ones to reach the dump, and when he touched a box, a whole pile of them fell over. He fled, zigzagging, but circled back in case Johnny needed help.
But help? He needed no help.
And he told them how Johnny had killed the three cyclos.
With his bare hands and a rifle butt?
And had
blown the whole lot sky high.
And he'd
looked like a David fighting three Goliaths.
There wouldn't be any pursuit.
"I hid behind the horse 200 feet away and moved it closer when the cyclos all met at the bodies. The horse wasn't hit in the blast, but a piece of gun must have slashed into a buffalo that was standing near the dump."
"Yes, I saw the buffalo."
"I ran into it going in."
"Is that what that shadow was?"
murmured various raiders.
"Some big cyclo, maybe your demon, Johnny, came down," continued Dunnell Dean, "and flashed lights around. And they figured out the buffalo had overturned the boxes, and the sentries had gone hunting on watch. Oh, they were cross at the sentries for that. And stumbled and dug a blast rifle into the dirt, and it went off and killed them."
Johnny expelled a sigh of relief. He hadn't known about the buffalo, but he had intended them to think the rest of it. He had even recovered the burned-off thong. The explosion would have masked the other damage, and he'd found his kill club in a mad last-second scramble before escape. Yes, there was no evidence.
"What a raid!"
exulted Dunnell Dean.
"And oh, what a bonny chief our Johnny is!"
Johnny sipped at the whiskey the parson gave him to hide his embarrassment.
"You're a scamp," said Robert the Fox to Dunnell Dean. "You might have been caught."
"Ah, but we had to know new, didn't we?"
laughed Dunnell Dean, unabashed. They wanted to parade the pipers, but Robert the Fox would give no clue to the eyes of a watching enemy that tonight was any different. He sent them to bed. Well, thought Johnny as he settled down in the wool plaid blanket, they had their uranium detector, perhaps. But that didn't help Chrissy. No radio, no personal contact. How was he going to force Turl to come over? 5. A haggard, nervous Turl approached the rendezvous. He drove his big armored ground car with one paw and held the other on the firing triggers of the fully charged heavy guns. He had not figured out Jayed's presence on Earth. The Imperial Bureau of Investigation agent had been assigned to a lowly ore-sorting post by personnel. Turl had not dared suggest any assignment. An ore-sorter only worked when there was ore coming up at the end of shifts, and a fellow could disappear off the post for hours and not be missed, and reappear as though he'd been there all the time. Turl dared not put surveillance equipment near him, for Jayed was a past master at that, after decades in the IBI. Turl had tried to get Jayed involved with Chirk, his secretary. He offered Chirk wild promises if she could get Jayed into bed with her, with a button camera of the smallest size embedded in a mole. But Jayed had paid no attention to her. He had just gone on shuffling about, head down, giving the exact appearance of an employee up to absolutely nothing. But what else? That was how the IBI would work. With shaking paws, Turl had ransacked the dispatch boxes to Home Planet. There was nothing from J-Ed in them. No new types of reports, no strange alterations of routine paper. Turl had spent agonizing nights going through the traffic. He could find nothing. Rumbling about, feeling like he was spinning, Turl had tried to figure out whether the IBI had invented some new means of communication. The company and the Imperial government did not invent things. They had not, to Turl's knowledge, for the last 100,000 years. But still, there could always be something he didn't know about, like writing on ore samples being shipped through. But it would take a specifically designated ore, and there was no departure he could find. The Imperial government was usually only interested in the company's ore volumes. The government got a percentage. But it could also intervene in matters of serious crime or intended crime. Turl could not find what J-Ed was doing. And the appearance of a deadly secret agent on the base, with falsified papers, had not permitted Turl a single relaxed moment for the past 2 months. He did his own work with a fury and an impeccable thoroughness quite foreign to him. He got through investigations at once. He answered all dispatches at once. Anything questionable in his files was buried or destroyed at once. Turl had even personally overhauled and fueled and charged the 20 battle planes in the field so that he would appear alert and efficient. He had filed a banal report about the animals. There were dangerous posts in mining, slopes one could not get into, and as an experiment, ordered by Numpf, he had rounded up a few animals to see whether they could run simpler machine types. The animals were not dangerous. They were actually stupid and slow to learn. It did not cost the company anything, and it might increase their profits in case the experiment worked out. It was not very successful yet, anyway. Nothing was taught the animals about metallurgy or warfare, both because of company policy and because they were too stupid. They ate rats, a vermin plentiful on this planet. He sent the report through with no priority. He was covered. He hoped. But 15 times a day, Turl decided that he should wipe out the animals and return the machines to storage. And 15 times a day, he decided to go on with it just a little longer. The sentry affair had disturbed him, not because Cyclos had been killed, he needed the dead bodies for his plans, but because one of the sentries, when Turl put the body in a coffin for transshipment next year, had had a criminal brand burned into the fur of his chest. This 3-bar brand was put on criminals by the Imperial government. It represented someone barred from justice procedures, barred from government assistance, and barred from employment. It meant the personnel department on the home planet was careless. He had made an innocuous report of it. For a flaming moment of hope, he thought perhaps J-Ed might be investigating that, or looking for some such. But when he had a fellow employee mention it casually to J-Ed, no interest had been shown. Turl simply could not find out what J-Ed was looking for, nor why J-Ed was there. The tension and uncertainty of it had brought him near to perpetual hysteria. And this morning, out of the blue, the animal had done something that literally stood Turl's fur on end with terror. As was his usual practice, Turl was stripping the day's photos from the recon drone receiver when he found himself looking at a photo of the mine site with a sign in it. There, sharp and clear, at the load, was the animal steadying a huge 12-by-12-foot sign. It was resting on a flat place the animals had made back of the load. In clearest cyclo script, it said, "Urgent. Meeting vital. Same place, same time." That was bad enough. But a machine tarpaulin seemed to have fallen over the last part of the sign. There was another line. It said, "The W something." Turl couldn't read the rest of it. The stupid animal apparently had not noticed part of its sign was obscured. With shaking claws, Turl had tried to find another frame in the sequence that looked back of the tarpaulin. He could not. Panic gripped him. Gradually, his scattered wits collected down to seething anger. The panic died out as he realized that his was the only recon drone receiver on the planet. The telltale on the side of it that showed whether anything else was receiving was mute. He daily watched these photos and had exactly tracked the progress at the load. The animal he had captured always seemed to be there with the crew. While all these animals looked alike, he thought he could recognize the blonde beard and size of the one he had trained. This usually reassured him, for it seemed to mean the animal was busy and not wandering around elsewhere. The progress at the load was minimal, but he knew the problems of mining it, and he also knew they might solve them without his advice. He had months to go, 4 months more, actually, before day 92. He got over his panic and shredded the photos. J-Ed had no possible access to them. But to directly link Turl with the project was not to be allowed. He began to imagine that the sign had started with his name, and regretted having shredded it so fast. He should have made sure. Maybe it did start Turl. Turl was not introspective enough to realize that he was bordering upon insanity. The darkness spread like a black sack over the tank. He had been driving on instruments without lights. It was treacherous terrain. An old city had been here once, but it was now just a honeycomb of abandoned mine holes where the company had followed an old deposit centuries before. Something showed on his detector screen right ahead. Something live. His paw rested alertly on the firing knob, ready to blast. He cautiously made sure he was headed away from the compound and masked by a hill and ancient walls. Then he turned on a dim inspection light. The animal was sitting on a horse at the rendezvous point. It was a different horse, a wild horse, nervous because of the tank. The dim green tank light bathed the rider. There was another, someone else. No, it was just another horse. It had a large pack on its back. Turl swept his scanners around. No, there was nobody else here. He looked back at the animal. Turl's paw quivered an inch above the firing lever. The animal did not seem to be alarmed. The interior of the tank was compressed with breathe gas, but Turl also had on a breathe mask. He adjusted it. Turl picked up an intercom unit and pushed it through the atmosphere-tight firing port. The unit fell to the ground outside the tank. Turl picked up the interior unit. "Get down off that horse and pick up this intercom," ordered Turl. Johnny slid off the half-broken horse and approached the tank. He picked the unit off the ground and looked through the tank ports for Turl. He could see nothing. The interior was dark and the glass was set to block a view in. Through the intercom, Turl said, "Did you kill those sentries?" Johnny held the outside unit to his face. He thought fast. This Turl was in a very strange state. "We haven't lost any sentries," he said truthfully.
"You know the sentries I mean. At the compound."
"Have you had trouble?" said Johnny. The word trouble almost made Turl's head spin. He didn't know what trouble he had, or what kind of trouble, or from where. He got a grip on himself.
"You obscured the last part of that sign," he said accusingly.
"Oh?" said Johnny innocently. He had obscured it on purpose so that Turl would come. "It meant to say, the winter is advancing and we need your advice." Turl simmered down. "Advice?
About what?"
He knew about what. It was next to impossible to get out that gold. But there had to be a way, and he was a miner. Top student of the school, actually. And he studied the recon drone pictures daily. He knew the flexing rods would not let them build a platform.
"You need a portable shaft stairway. You've got one in your equipment. You nail it to the outside face and work from it."
"All right," said Johnny. "We'll try it." He had Turl calmer now that he was on a routine subject of interest. "We also need some protection in case of uranium," said Johnny.
Why?
There's uranium in those mountains, said Johnny.
In the gold?
I don't think so. In the valleys and around. Johnny thought he had better emphasize that Turl was barred from those places. And also, he was desperate for the data.